With respect, said the innkeeper. Without respect. But don't be complaining about what I warned you of. These days it's easy to get a sore head in the Dwarven District, if anything were to happen.
If what were to happen?
How would I know? Is it any business of mine?
Let's go, Geralt, urged Dandelion, seeing out of the corner of one eye that the war-damaged youngsters, those who were still reasonably conscious, were observing them with eyes shining with fishtech.
Goodbye, Master Innkeeper. Who knows? Perhaps we'll visit your establishment one day, in a while, once those signs have gone from the entrance.
And which one don't you gentlemen like?
The innkeeper frowned and stood with legs aggressively apart.
Eh? The one about the dwarf, perhaps?
No, the one about the cook.
Three youngsters got up from the table, slightly unsteady on their feet, clearly intending to bar their way. A girl and two boys in black jackets, with swords on their backs. Geralt didn't slow his stride. He walked on, and his face and eyes were cold and totally indifferent. Almost at the last moment, the striplings parted, stepping back. Dandelion smelled the beer on their breath, and sweat, and fear.
You have to get used to it, said the Witcher when they were outside. You have to adapt.
It's hard sometimes.
That's no argument. That's no argument, Dandelion.
The air was hot, dense and sticky, like soup. Outside, in front of the inn, the two boys in black jackets were helping the fair-haired girl wash in a horse trough. The girl snorted incoherently, indicating that she was feeling better and announced that she needed a drink. And of course she'd go to the bazaar to overturn some stalls for a lark, but first she needed a drink. The girl's name was Nadia Esposito. That name became etched into the annals. It passed into history. But Geralt and Dandelion couldn't have known that then. Neither could the girl. The narrow streets of the city of Rivia bustled with life, and what seemed to wholly occupy the residents and visitors was trade. It seemed as though everybody was trading in everything there and trying to exchange anything for something more. A cacophony of shouts resounded from all sides. Goods were being advertised. People were bargaining heatedly, insulting each other, thunderously accusing each other of cheating, thievery and swindles, as well as other peccadilloes, absolutely unconnected to commerce. Before Geralt and Dandelion had reached Elm, they were presented with a great deal of attractive offers. They were offered, among other things, an astrolabe, a brass trumpet, a set of cutlery decorated with the coat of arms of the Frangipani family, stocks in a copper mine, a large jar of leeches, a tattered book entitled An Alleged Miracle or the Medusa's Head, a pair of ferrets, an elixir to increase potency, and, as part of a package deal, a none too young, none too slim, and none too fresh woman. A black-bearded dwarf tried to convince them extremely aggressively to buy a shoddy little mirror in a pinchbeck frame, attempting to prove it was the magical looking-glass of Cambuscan, when soon after somebody threw a stone and knocked the wear out of his hand.
"Lousy kobold!"
bellowed a barefoot and dirty street urchin.
"Unhuman, bearded old goat!"
"And may your guts rot, you human shithead!" roared the dwarf. "May they rot and leak out of your ass!"
People looked on in gloomy silence. The district of Elm lay right beside the lake, in a bay among alders, weeping willows, and, naturally, elms. It was much more quiet and peaceful. No one bought anything or wanted to sell anything here. A light breeze was blowing from the lake, especially pleasant after getting out of the stuffy, fly-blown stink of the city. They didn't have to search long to find Versing's tavern. The first passerby they encountered pointed it out to them without hesitation. Two bearded dwarves, sipping beer from mugs hugged against their bellies, were sitting beneath a roof covered in bright green moss and swallows' nests on the steps of a porch enveloped in climbing peas and wild roses.
"Geralt and Dandelion," said one of the dwarves and belched daintily. "What took you so long, you rogues?"
Geralt dismounted.
"Greetings, Yarpen Zegrin. Glad to see you, Zoltan Chive."
They were the only guests of the tavern, which smelled strongly of roast meat, garlic, herbs, and something else, something elusive but very pleasant. They sat at a heavy table with a view of the lake, which looked mysterious, charming and romantic through tinted panes in lead frames.
"Where's Ciri?" Yarp and Zigrin asked bluntly. "She can't be..."
"No," Geralt quickly interrupted. "She's coming here. She'll be here any moment. Well, beardies, tell us how things are going."
"Didn't I say," Yarpin said with a sneer, "didn't I say, Zoltan, comes back from the end of the world, where if rumours can be believed he waded in blood, killed dragons, and overthrew empires, and he asks us how things are going. That's the Witcher all over. What smells so appetizing here?"
Dandelion interjected.
"Dinner," said Yarpin Zigrin. "Meat." "Dandelion, ask me where we got the meat."
"I won't, because I know that joke.
Don't be a swine." "Where did you get the meat?"
"Crawldeer itself."
"And now, more seriously..."
Yarpin wiped away tears, although the joke, to tell the truth, was pretty hoary.
"The situation with victuals is quite critical, as usual after a war. You won't find meat, not even poultry. It's also hard to get fish. Things are bad with flour and spuds, peas and beans. Farms have been burned down, stores plundered, fish ponds emptied, and fields lie fallow."
"There's no turnover," added Zoltan. "There's no transport. Only usury and barter are functioning. Did you see the bazaar? Profiteers are making fortunes beside beggars selling and exchanging the remains of their possessions. If the crops fail on top of that, people will begin to die of hunger in the winter."
"Is it really that bad?"
"Riding from the south, you must have passed villages and settlements. Think back to how often you heard dogs barking."
"Bloody hell!" Dandelion slapped himself on the forehead.
"I knew it! I told you, Geralt, that it wasn't normal, that something was missing. Ha! Now I get it. We didn't hear any dogs. There weren't any around."
He suddenly broke off and glanced towards the kitchen and the smell of garlic and herbs with terror in his eyes.
"Fear not," snorted Yarpin. "Our meat doesn't come from anything that barks, meows, or calls out mercy. Our meat is totally different. It's fit for kings."
"Let us in on it, dwarf."
"When we received your letter and it was clear we'd meet in Rivia, Zoltan and I pondered over what to serve you. We racked our brains, till all our racking made us want to piss, and then we went down to a little lakeside alder. We looked, and there were positively tons of snails. So we took a sack and caught a load of the dear mollusks, as many as we could stuff in it."
"A lot of them escaped," Zoltan Chire nodded. "We were a tad drunk and they're devilish fast."
Again, both dwarves wept with laughter at another old chestnut.
"This thing,"
Yarpin pointed at the innkeeper bustling around by the stove, "knows how to cook snails, and that, you ought to know, demands considerable arcane knowledge. He nonetheless is a born chef de cuisine. Before he became a widower, he and his wife ran the roadhouse in Maribor, with such a table that the king himself entertained guests there. We'll soon be tucking in, I tell you."
"And before that," nodded Zoltan, "we'll have a starter of freshly smoked whitefish caught on a gaff in the bottomless depths of this lake, and we'll wash it down with hooch from the depths of the cellar."
"Man the story, gentlemen," reminded Yarpin, pouring.
"The story."
The whitefish was still hot, oily, and smelled of smoke from alder chips. The vodka was so cold it stung the teeth. Dandelion spoke first, elaborately, fluently, colourfully and volubly, embellishing his tale with ornaments so beautiful and fanciful they almost obscured the fibs and confabulations. Then the Witcher spoke. He spoke the same truth, and spoke so dryly, boringly and flatly, that Dandelion couldn't bear it and kept butting in, for which the dwarves reprimanded him. And then the story was over, and a lengthy silence fell.
"To the Archer Milver."
Zoltan Chive cleared his throat, saluting with his cup.
"To the Nilfgaardian. To Regis the Herbalist, who entertained the travellers in his cottage with moonshine and mandrake. And to Angoulême, whom I never knew. May the earth lie lightly on them all. May they have in the beyond plenty of whatever they were short of on earth. And may their names live forever in songs and tales. Let's drink to them."
Versing, a grey-haired fellow, pale and thin as a rake, the sheer opposite of the stereotype of an innkeeper and master of culinary secrets, brought to the table a basket of snow-white aromatic bread, and after that, a huge wooden dish of snails on a bed of horseradish leaves, sizzling and spitting garlic butter. Dandelion, Geralt and the dwarves set about eating with a will. The meal was exquisitely tasty, and at the same time extremely comical, considering the need to fiddle with bizarre tongs and little forks. They ate, smacked their lips, and caught the dripping butter on bread. They swore cheerfully as one snail after another slipped from the tongs. Two young kittens had great fun rolling and chasing the empty shells across the floor. The smell coming from the kitchen indicated that Virsing was cooking another batch. Yarp and Zigrin reluctantly waved a hand, but realized that the Witcher wouldn't give up.
"Nothing new with me by and large," he said, sucking out a shell. "A bit of soldiering, a bit of politicking because I was elected Vice Starosta. I'm going to make a career in politics. There's great competition in every other trade. And there are no end of fools, bribe-takers and thieves in politics. It's easy to make a name for yourself." "Well, I don't have a flair for politics," said Zoltan Chive, gesticulating with a snail held in his tongs. "I'm setting up a steam and water hammer works in partnership with Figgs Maruzzo and Munro Broice. Remember them, Witcher? Figgs and Broice?" "Not just them." "Yezan Varda fell at the Battle of the Yoruga," Zoltan informed them dryly. "Pretty stupidly, in one of the last skirmishes."
"Shame. And Percival Schuttenbach?"
"The gnome? Oh, he's doing well. The crafty thing. He got out of the draft using some ancient gnomish laws as an excuse, claiming his religion forbade him from soldiering. And he managed it, even though everybody knows he'd give the whole pantheon of gods and goddesses for a marinated herring. He has a jeweler's workshop in Novigrad. Do you know, he bought that parrot Field Marshal Duda and turned the bird into a living advertisement after teaching it to call diamonds, diamonds. And just imagine, it works. The gnome has lots of custom, hands full of work, and a well-stuffed safe. Yes, yes, that's Novigrad. Money lies in the streets there. That's also why we want to start our hammerworks in Novigrad." "People will be smearing shit on your door," said Yarpin, "and throwing stones at the windows and calling you a filthy short ass. It won't help you at all that you're a war veteran, that you fought for them. You'll be a pariah in that Novigrad of yours."
"You're right," said Zoltan cheerfully. "There's too much competition in Mahakam and too many politicians. Let's drink a toast, lads, to Caleb Stratton and Yezon Varda."
"To Regan Dahlberg,"
added Yarpin, growing gloomy. Geralt shook his head.
"Regan, too. Aye, at Maena. Old Mrs. Dahlberg was left a widow. Ah, by the devil, enough, enough of that, let's drink. And hurry with those snails. I see Virsing's bringing another bowl."
The dwarves, belts loosened, listened to Geralt's story about how Dandelion's ducal romance finished up on the scaffold. The poet pretended to be piqued and didn't comment. Yarpin and Zoltan roared with laughter.
"Yes, yes," said Yarpin Zigrin at the end, grinning. "As the old song goes, though man can bend rods of steel, women will always bring him to heel. Several wonderful examples of the aptness of that adage are gathered around one table today. Zoltan Chive springs to mind. When I told you what's new with him, I forgot to add he's taken a wife. And soon, in September, the lucky girl is called Eudora Brekkekex. Breckenrigs," Zoltan corrected emphatically, frowning. "I'm beginning to have enough of correcting your pronunciation, Zigrin. Take heed, for I'm liable to start cracking heads when I've had enough of something."
"Where's the wedding? And when exactly?" Dandelion interrupted in mid-sentence placatingly. "I'm asking because we might look in, if you invite us, naturally."
"It hasn't been decided what, where or how, or even if it's happening," Zoltan mumbled, clearly disconcerted. "Yarpin's getting ahead of himself. Eudora and I are engaged right enough, but who knows what might happen in these fuck-awful times."
"The second example of women's omnipotence," continued Yarpin Zigrin, "is Geralt of Rivia, the Witcher."
Geralt pretended to be occupied with a snail. Yarpin snorted.
"Having miraculously regained Ciri," he continued, "he lets her ride off, agreeing to another farewell. He leaves her on her own again, although, as somebody here rightly observed, the times are not too peaceful, for fuck's sake.
and said witcher does all that because that's what a certain woman wants.
The witcher always does everything that that woman, known to society as Yennefer of Vingerberg, wants. And if only said witcher got any benefit from it. But he doesn't. Indeed, as King Desmond used to say when looking into his chamber pot after completing a motion, the mind is unable to grasp it. I suggest,
Geralt raised his cup with a charming smile,
we drink up and change the subject.
Well said, said Dandelion and Zoltan in unison. Virsing brought to the table a third and then a fourth great bowl of snails. Neither did he forget, naturally, about the bread and vodka. The diners had now eaten their fill, so it was no surprise that toasts were being drunk somewhat more frequently. Neither was it a surprise that philosophy crept into the discourse more and more often.
The evil I fought against, repeated the Witcher, was a sign of the activities of chaos, activities calculated to disturb order. Since wherever evil is at large, order may not reign, and everything order builds collapses, cannot endure. The light of wisdom and the flame of hope, the glow of warmth, instead of flaring up, go out. It'll be dark, and in the darkness will be fangs, claws and blood.
Joppen Zigrin stroked his beard, greasy from the herb and garlic butter that had dripped from the snails.
Very prettily said, Witcher, he admitted. But, as the young Sero said to King Vridenek during their first tryst, it's not a bad-looking thing, but does it have any practical use?
The reason for existence,
the Witcher didn't smile,
and the raison d'etre of witches has been undermined since the fight between good and evil is now being waged on a different battlefield, and is being fought completely differently. Evil has stopped being chaotic. It has stopped being a blind and impetuous force against which a witcher, a mutant as murderous and chaotic as evil itself, had to act. Today, evil acts according to rights because it is entitled to. It acts according to peace treaties because it was taken into consideration when the treaties were being written.
You've seen the settlers being driven south,
guessed Zoltan Chive. Not only that, Dandelion added grimly. Not only that.
So what?
Yarpin Zigrin sat more comfortably, locking his hands on his belly.
Everyone's seen things. Everybody's been pissed off. Everybody's lost his appetite for a shorter or a longer time. Or lost sleep. That's how it is. That's how it was. And how it's going to be. Like these shells here. I swear you won't squeeze any more philosophy out of it, because there isn't any more.
What's not to your liking, Witcher? What doesn't suit you?
The changes the world's undergoing? Development? Progress?
Perhaps.
Yarpen said nothing for a long time, looking at the Witcher from under his bushy eyebrows.
Progress, he said finally, is like a herd of pigs. That's how you should look at progress. That's how you should judge it. Like a herd of pigs trotting around a farmyard. Numerous benefits derive from the fact of that herd's existence. There's pork knuckle, there's sausage, there's fatback, there are trotters in Aspic. In a word, there are benefits. There's no point turning your nose up at the shit everywhere.
They were all silent for some time, weighing up in their minds and consciences the various important issues and matters.
Let's have a drink, said Dandelion finally.
No one protested.
Progress, said Yarpin Zigrin amidst the silence, will eventually light up the darkness. The darkness will yield before the light, but not right away, and definitely not without a fight.
Geralt, staring at the window, smiled at his own thoughts and dreams.
The darkness you're talking about, he said, is a state of mind, not matter. Quite different witches will have to be trained to fight something like that. It's high time to start.
Start retraining? Is that what you had in mind?
Not entirely.
Being a witcher doesn't interest me any longer. I'm retiring.
Like hell.
I'm totally serious. I'm done with being a witcher.
A long silence fell, broken only by the furious meowing of the kittens, which were scratching and biting one another under the table, faithful to the custom of that species for whom there's no sport without pain.
"He's done with being a witcher,"
Jafnzigrin finally repeated in a drawling voice.
"Ha! I don't know what to think about it, as King Desmond said when he was caught cheating at cards. But one may suspect the worse. Dandelion, you travelled with him, spend a lot of time with him. Is he showing any other signs of paranoia?"
"Yes, yes." Geralt was stony-faced. "Joking aside, as King Desmond said when the guests at the banquet suddenly began to go blue and die, I've said what I intended to say. And now to action."
He picked up his sword from the back of the chair.
"This is your sile, Zoltan Chive. I return it to you with thanks and a low bow. It has served. It has helped. Saved lives and taken lives."
"Witcher!"
The dwarf raised his hands in a defensive gesture.
"The sword is yours. I didn't lend it to you. I gave it. Gifts, quiet, Chive. I'm returning your sword. I don't need it any longer."
"Like hell," repeated Yarpin. "Pour him some vodka, Dandelion, because he sounds like old Schrader when a pickaxe fell on his head down a mineshaft. Geralt, I know you have a profound nature and a lofty soul, but don't talk such crap, please, because, as it's easy to see, neither Yennefer nor any other of your magical concubines are in the audience, just us old buggers. You can't tell old buggers like us that your sword's not needed, that witches aren't needed, that the world's rotten, that this, that and the other. You're a witcher, and always will be. No, I won't."
Geralt responded mildly.
"It may surprise you old buggers, but I've come to the conclusion that pissing into the wind is stupid, that risking your neck for anybody is stupid, even if they're paying. And existential philosophy has nothing to do with it. You won't believe it, but my own skin has suddenly become extremely dear to me. I've come to the conclusion it will be foolish to risk it in someone else's defence."
"I've noticed," Dandelion nodded. "On one hand, that's wise. On the other..."
"There is no other."
"Do Yennefer and Ciri," Yarpin asked after a short pause, "have anything to do with your decision?"
"A great deal."
"Then everything's clear," sighed the dwarf. "Admittedly, I don't exactly know how you, a professional swordsman, intend to sustain yourself and intend to organise your worldly existence, even though, however you slice it, I can't see you in the role of, let's say, a cabbage planter. Nonetheless, one must respect your choice. Innkeeper, if you be so kind, this is a Mahakam Sile sword from the very forge of Rundurin. It was a gift. The receiver doesn't want it. The giver may not take it back. So you take it. Fasten it above the fireplace. Change the name of the tavern to the Witch's Sword. Me tales of treasure and monsters, of bloody wars and fierce battles, of death be told here on winter evenings, of great love and unfailing friendship, of courage and honour. May this sword cheer up the listeners and inspire the storytellers. And now, pour me vodka, gentlemen, for I shall continue talking, shall present profound truths and diverse philosophies, including existential ones."
The cups were filled with vodka silently and solemnly. They looked into each other's eyes and drank, no less solemnly. Jafnzigrin cleared his throat, swept his eyes over his audience, and made certain they were sufficiently rapt and solemn.
"Progress," he said with reverence, "will lighten up the gloom, for that is what progress is, for as, if you'll pardon me, the asshole is for shitting. It will be brighter and brighter, and we shall fear less and less the darkness and the evil hidden in it. And a day will come, perhaps, when we shall stop believing at all that something is lurking in the darkness. We shall laugh at such fears, call them childish, be ashamed of them. But darkness will always, always exist. And there will always be evil in the darkness, always be fangs and claws, death and blood in the darkness, and witches will always be needed."
They sat in reflection and silence, so deeply plunged in their thoughts that the suddenly increasing murmur and noise of the town, angry, baleful, intensifying like the buzzing of annoyed wasps, escaped their attention. They barely noticed as a first, a second, and a third shape stole along the silent and empty lakeside boulevard. Just as a roar exploded over the town, the door to Versing's inn slammed wide open, and a small dwarf rushed in, red from effort, and panting heavily.
"What is it?"
Yupin Zigrin lifted his head. The dwarf, still unable to catch his breath, pointed towards the town centre. His eyes were frantic.
"Take a deep breath," advised Zoltan Chive, "and tell us what's going on."
It was said later that the tragic events in Rivia were an absolutely chance occurrence, that it was a spontaneous reaction, a sudden and unpredictable explosion of justified anger, springing from the mutual hostility and dislike between humans, dwarves and elves. It was said that it wasn't the humans but the dwarves who attacked first, that the aggression came from them, that a dwarven market trader had insulted a young noblewoman, Nadia Esposito, a war orphan, that he had used violence against her. When then her friends came to her defence, the dwarf mustered his fellows. A scuffle broke out, and then a fight, which took over the whole bazaar in an instant. The fight turned into a massacre, into a massed attack by humans on the part of the suburbs occupied by non-humans and the district of Elm. In less than an hour from the time of the incident at the bazaar to the intervention by sorcerers, 184 individuals had been killed, and almost half of the victims were women and children. Professor Emmerich Gostschalk of Ochsenfurt gives the same version of events in his dissertation. But there were also those who said something different. How could it have been spontaneous? How could it have been a sudden and unforeseeable explosion, they asked, if in the course of a few minutes from the altercation at the bazaar, wagons had appeared in the streets from which people began to hand out weapons? How could it have been sudden and justified anger if the ringleaders of the mob, who were the most visible and active during the massacre, were people no one knew and who had arrived in Rivia several days before the riots from God knows where, and afterwards vanished without trace? Why did the army intervene so late and so tentatively at first? Still, other scholars tried to identify Nilfgaardian provocation in the Rivian riots, and there were those who claimed it was all concocted by the dwarves and elves together, that they had killed each other to blacken the name of the humans. Utterly lost among the serious academic voices was the extremely bold theory of a certain young and eccentric graduate who, until he was silenced, claimed that it was not conspiracies or secret plots that had manifested themselves in Rivia, but the simple and indeed universal traits of the local people: ignorance, xenophobia, callous boorishness, and thorough brutishness. And then everybody lost interest in the matter and stopped talking about it at all.
"Into the cellar," repeated the witcher,
anxiously listening to the quickly growing roar and yelling of the mob.
"Dwarves, into the cellar, without any stupid heroics."
"Witcher,"
Zoltan grunted, clenching the haft of his battle-axe.
"I can't. My brothers are dying out there."
"Into the cellar. Think about Eudora Brekkekex. Do you want her to be a widow before her wedding?"
The argument worked. The dwarves went down into the cellar. Geralt and Dandelion covered the entrance with straw mats. Versing, who was usually pale, was now white as cottage cheese.
"I saw a pogrom in Maribor,"
he stammered out, looking at the entrance to the cellar.
"If they find them there, go to the kitchen."
Dandelion was also pale. Geralt wasn't especially surprised. Individual accents were sounding in the hitherto indistinct and monotonous roar that reached their ears, notes that made their hair stand up on their heads.
"Geralt," groaned the poet, "I'm somewhat similar to an elf."
"Don't be stupid."
Clouds of smoke billowed above the rooftops, and fugitives dashed out of a narrow street. Dwarves of both sexes. Two dwarves dived into the lake without thinking and began to swim, churning up the water, straight ahead towards the middle. The others dispersed. Some of them turned towards the tavern. The mob rushed out of the narrow street. They were quicker than the dwarves. Lust for slaughter was winning out in this race. The screaming of people being killed pierced the ears and made the coloured glass in the tavern's windows jingle. Geralt felt his hands begin to shake. One dwarf was literally torn apart, rent into pieces. Another, thrown onto the ground, was turned into a shapeless bloody mass in a few moments. A woman was stabbed with pitchforks and pikes, and the child she had defended until the end was trampled, crushed under the blows of boot heels. Three of them, a dwarf and two dwarf women, fled straight towards the tavern. The crowd raced after them, yelling. Geralt took a deep breath. He stood up, feeling on him the terrified eyes of Dandelion and Virsing. He took the sile, the sword wrought in Mahakam, in the very forge of Rundurin, down from the shelf over the fireplace.
"Geralt,"
the poet groaned pathetically.
"Very well," said the Witcher, walking towards the exit. "But this is the last time. Damn it, it really is the last time."
He went out onto the porch and jumped straight down from it, filleting, with a rapid slash, a roughneck in bricklayer's overalls who was aiming a blow with a trowel at a woman. He cut off the hand of the next one, who was grasping the hair of another woman. He hacked down two men kicking a dwarf on the ground with two swift diagonal slashes. And he entered the crowd quickly, spinning around in half turns. He cut with wide blows, apparently chaotically, knowing that such strokes are bloodier and more spectacular. He didn't mean to kill them. He just wanted to wound them.
"He's an elf! He's an elf!" yelled someone in the mob savagely. "Kill the elf!" "That's going too far," he thought. "Dandelion, perhaps, but I don't resemble an elf in any way."
He spotted the one who had shouted, probably a soldier, because he was wearing a brigantine and high boots. The Witcher wormed his way into the crowd like an eel. The soldier shielded himself with a javelin held in both hands. Geralt cut along the shaft, chopping off the soldier's fingers. The Witcher whirled, bringing forth shrieks of pain and fountains of blood with the next broad stroke.
"Mercy!"
An unkempt young man with crazy eyes fell on his knees in front of him.
"Spare me!"
Geralt spared him, stopped the movement of his arm and sword, using the momentum intended for the blow to spin away. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw the unkempt youth spring to his feet and saw what he was holding. Geralt interrupted the turn to spin back the other way, but he was stuck in the crowd. He was stuck in the crowd for a split second. All he could do was watch as the three-fanged fork flew towards him. The fire in the grate of the huge hearth went out, and it grew dark in the hall. The strong wind, gusting from the mountains, whistled in the cracks in the walls, wailed, blowing in through the draughty shutters of Kaer Morhen, the seat of the witches.
"Damn it!" Eskil blurted out,
stood up and opened the sideboard.
"Seagull? Or vodka?"
"Vodka,"
said Cohen and Geralt as one.
"Of course," said Vesemir, hidden in the shadows. "Of course, naturally. Drown your stupidity in booze, sodding fools."
"It was an accident," muttered Lambert. "She was managing well, Macomb."
"Shut your trap, you ass. I don't want to hear your voice. I tell you, if anything's the matter with the girl..."
"She's good now," Cohen interrupted gently. "She's sleeping peacefully, deeply and soundly. She'll wake up a bit sore, and that's all. She won't remember at all about the trance or what happened."
"As long as you remember," panted Vesemir. "Blockheads! Pour me one too, Eskil."
They were silent for a long time, engrossed in the howling of the wind.
"We'll have to summon someone," said Eskil finally. "We'll have to get some witch to come. It's not normal what's happening to that girl." "That's the third trance already, but it's the first time she's used articulated speech. Tell me again what she said," ordered Vesemir,
emptying the goblet in one draught.
"Word for word." "I can't tell you word for word," said Geralt, staring into the embers. "And the meaning, if there's any point looking for meaning in it, was me and Cohen are going to die. Teeth will be our undoing. We'll both be killed by teeth. In his case, two, in mine, three."
"It's quite likely we'll be bitten to death," snorted Lambert. "Teeth could be the downfall of any of us at any moment. Although if that prediction is a real prophecy, you two will be finished off by some extremely gap-toothed monsters."
"Or by purulent gangrene from rotten teeth,"
Eskel nodded, apparently serious.
"Except our teeth aren't rotting." "I wouldn't make fun of the matter," said Vesemir.
The witchers said nothing. The wind howled, and whistled in the walls of Caer Morhen. The unkempt young man, as though horrified by what he'd done, dropped the shaft. The Witcher cried out in pain in spite of himself and bent over. The trident, sticking into his stomach, overbalanced him, and when he fell onto his knees, it slid out of his body and fell onto the cobbles. Blood poured out with a swoosh and a splash worthy of a waterfall. Geralt tried to rise from his knees. Instead, he fell over on his side. The sounds around him resonated and echoed. He heard them as though his head was underwater. His vision was also blurred, with distorted perspective and totally false geometry. But he saw the crowd take flight, saw them run from the relief, from Zoltan and Yarpin holding battle axes, Versing holding a meat cleaver, and Dandelion armed with a broom. "Stop," he wanted to cry. "Where are you going? It's enough that I always piss into the wind." But he couldn't cry out. His voice was choked by a gush of blood. It was getting towards noon when the sorceresses reached Rivia. Down below, viewed from the perspective of the highway, the surface of Loch Escalot glittered with the sparkling reflections of the castle's red tiles and the town's roofs.
"Well, we've arrived," stated Yennefer. "Rivia! How strange are the twists of fate."
Ciri, who had been excited for a long time, made Kelpie dance and take short steps. Triss Merigold sighed imperceptibly. At least she thought it was imperceptible.
"Well, well."
Yennefer glared at her.
"What strange sounds are lifting your virgin breast, Triss? Ciri, ride on ahead and see if you're already there."
Triss turned her face away, determined not to provoke or give any pretext. She wasn't counting on a result. For a long time, she had sensed the anger and aggression in Yennefer getting stronger the closer they got to Rivia.
"You, Triss," Yennefer repeated scathingly. "Don't blush, don't sigh, don't slaver, and don't wiggle your bum in the saddle. Do you think that's why I yielded to your request, agreed to you coming with us? For a languorously blissful meeting with your erstwhile sweetheart? Ciri, I asked you to ride on ahead a little. Let us have a talk."
"It's a monologue, not a talk," said Ciri impertinently. But she yielded at once under the menacing violet glare, whistled at Kelpie, and galloped down the highway.
"You aren't riding to a rendezvous with your lover, Triss," Yennefer continued. "I'm neither so noble nor so stupid as to give you the chance and him the temptation. Just this once, today, and then I'll make sure that neither of you has any temptations or opportunities. But today, I won't deny myself that sweet and perverted pleasure. He knows about the role you played and will thank you for it with his eyes. And I shall look at your trembling lips and shaking hands, listen to your lame apologies and excuses. And do you know what, Triss? I'll be swooning with delight."
"I knew you wouldn't forget what I did, that you would take your revenge," muttered Triss. "I accept that, because I was indeed to blame. But I have to tell you one thing, Yennefer. Don't count too much on my swooning. He knows how to forgive. For what was done to him, indeed."
Yennefer squinted her eyes. "But he'll never forgive you for what was done to Ciri, and to me."
"Maybe," Triss swallowed. "Maybe he won't, particularly if you do your utmost to stop him. But he definitely won't bully me. He won't stoop to that."
Yennefer swiped her horse with her whip. The horse whinnied, jumped, and cavorted so suddenly that the sorceress swayed in the saddle.
"That's enough of this discussion," she snapped. "A little more humility, you arrogant slut. He's my man, mine, and only mine. Do you understand? You're to stop talking about him. You're to stop thinking about him. You're to stop delighting in his noble character. Right away, at once. I feel like grabbing you by that ginger mop of hair. Just you try," yelled Triss. "Just try, you bitch, and I'll scratch your eyes out.
They fell silent, seeing Ciri hurtling towards them in a cloud of dust. They knew right away that something was afoot, and saw at once what it was, before Ciri even reached them. Tongues of flame suddenly shot up over the thatched roofs of the now nearby suburbs and over the tiles and chimneys of the city, and smoke belched in billows. Screaming, like the distant buzzing of annoying flies, like the droning of angry bumblebees, reached the sorceress's ears. The screaming grew. It increased, counterpointed by single, high-pitched cries.
"What the bloody hell is going on there?"
Yennefer stood up in the stirrups.
"A raid? A fire? Geralt!"
Ciri suddenly groaned, becoming as white as vellum.
"Geralt!"
"Ciri, what's the matter with you?" Ciri raised her hand, and the sorceresses saw blood dribbling over it, along the lifeline.
"The circle has closed,"
said the girl, closing her eyes.
"A thorn from Shirawaith pricked me, and the snake Ouroboros has sunk its teeth into its own tail. I'm coming, Geralt. I'm coming to you. I won't leave you alone."
Before either of the sorceresses had time to protest, the girl had turned Kelpie around and galloped off at once. They had enough presence of mind to immediately urge their own horses into a gallop, but their steeds were no match for Kelpie.
"What is it?" screamed Yennefer, gulping the wind. "What's happening?" "But you know,"
sobbed Triss, galloping beside her.
"Fly, Yennefer!"
Before they had dashed among the shacks of the suburbs, before they were passed by the first fugitives fleeing the town, Yennefer already had a clear enough picture of the situation to know that what was happening in Rivia wasn't a fire or a raid by enemy troops, but a pogrom. She also knew what Ciri had felt, where and to whom she was rushing so quickly. She also knew she couldn't catch up with her. There was no chance. Kelpie had simply jumped over the panicked people, crushed together into a crowd, knocking off several hats and caps with her hooves. She and Triss had had to rein in their steeds so abruptly they almost tumbled over their horses' heads.
"Ciri, stop!"
They suddenly found themselves amidst narrow streets full of the running and wailing mob. As she passed, Yennefer noticed bodies lying in the gutters, saw corpses hanging by their legs from posts and beams. She saw a dwarf lying on the ground being kicked and beaten with sticks, saw another being battered with the necks of broken bottles. She heard the shouts of the assailants, the screaming and howling of the beaten. She saw a throng clustering around a woman who had been thrown from a window and the glint of metal bars rising and falling. The crowd closed in, the roar intensified. It seemed to the sorceresses that the distance between them and Ciri had shortened. The next obstacle in Kelpie's way was a small group of disorientated halberdiers, whom the black mare treated like a fence and jumped over, knocking a flat kettle hat off one of them. The others simply squatted down in fear. They burst into a square at full gallop. It was black with people and smoke. Yennefer realized that Ciri, unerringly, led by her prophetic vision, was heading for the very heart, the very center of events, to the very core of the conflagrations where murder was rampaging. For a battle was raging in the street she had turned towards. Dwarves and elves were fiercely defending a makeshift barricade, defending a lost position, falling and dying under the pressure of the howling rabble attacking them. Ciri screamed and pressed herself to her horse's neck. Kelpie took off and flew over the barricade, not like a horse, but like a huge black bird. Yennefer rode into the crowd and reined her horse in sharply, knocking a few people over. She was dragged from the saddle before she managed to yell. She was hit on the shoulders, on the back, and on the back of her head. She fell onto her knees and saw an unshaven character in a shoemaker's apron preparing to kick her. Yennefer had had enough of people kicking her. From her spread fingers shot pale blue hissing fire, cutting like a horsewhip the faces, torsos, and arms of the people surrounding her. There was a stench of burning flesh, and for a moment howling and squealing rose above the general commotion and hullabaloo.
"Witch! Elven witch! Enchantress!"
The next character leapt at her with a raised axe. Yennefer shot fire straight in his face. His eyeballs burst, seethed, and spilled out onto his cheeks with a hiss. The crowd thinned out. Someone grabbed her by the arm, and she recoiled, ready to fire. But it was Triss.
"Let's flee from here, Yenna. Flee from here." "I've heard her talking in a voice like that before," flashed a thought through Yennefer's head. "With lips like wood, that not even a droplet of saliva can moisten. lips that fear paralyzes, that panic makes tremble. I heard her talking in a voice like that, on Sodden Hill, when she was dying of fear. Now she's dying of fear too. She's going to die of fear her whole life, for whoever doesn't overcome the cowardice inside themselves will die of fear to the end of their days. The fingers that Triss dug into her arm seemed to be made of steel, and Yennefer only freed herself from their grasp with the greatest of effort. "Flee if you want to," she cried. "Hide behind the skirts of your lodge. I have something to defend. I shan't leave Ciri alone, or Geralt. Get away, you rabble. Out of the way if you value your lives." The crowd, separating her from her horse, retreated before the lightning bolts shooting from the sorceress's eyes and hands. Yennefer tossed her head, ruffling up her black locks. She looked like fury incarnate, like an angel of destruction, a punishing angel of destruction with a flaming sword. "Be gone! Get you home, you swine!" she yelled, lashing the rabble with a flaming whip. "Be gone, or I'll brand you with fire like cattle."
"It's only one witch, people,"
a resonant and metallic voice sounded from the crowd.
"A single bloody elven spellcaster."
"She's alone. The other bolted. Hey, children, take up stones."
"Death to the non-humans. War betide the witch. To her confusion."
The first stone whistled past her ear. The second thudded into her arm, making her stagger. The third hit her directly in the face. First, the pain exploded intensely in her eyes, then wrapped everything in black velvet. She came to, groaning in pain. Pain shot through both her forearms and wrists. She groped involuntarily, felt the thick layers of bandage. She groaned again, dully, despairingly, sorry that it wasn't a dream, and sorry that she'd failed.
"You didn't succeed," said Tessiah DeVries, sitting beside the bed.
Yennefer was thirsty. She wanted somebody to at least moisten her lips, which were covered in a sticky coating. But she didn't ask. Her pride wouldn't let her.
"You didn't succeed," repeated Tessiah DeVries. "But not because you didn't try hard. You cut well and deep. That's why I am here with you. Had it only been silly games, had it been a foolish, irresponsible demonstration, I would have nothing but contempt for you. But you cut deeply, purposefully."
Yennefer looked at the ceiling vacantly.
"I shall take care of you, girl, because I believe it's worth it. And it'll require a good deal of work. Oh, but it will. I'll not only have to straighten your spine and shoulder blade, but also heal your hands. When you slit your wrists, you severed the tendons, and a sorceress's hands are important instruments, Yennefer."
Moisture on her mouth. Water.
"You shall live."
Desire's voice was matter-of-fact, grave, stern even.
"Your time has not yet come. When it does, you will recall this day."
Yennefer greedily sucked the moisture from a stick wrapped in a wet bandage.
"I shall take care of you,"
Tessiah DeVries repeated, gently touching her hair.
"And now we are alone here, without witnesses. No one will see, and I shan't tell anyone. Weep, girl. Have a good cry. Weep your heart out for the last time. For later you won't be able to. There isn't a more hideous sight than a sorceress weeping."
She came to, hawked and coughed up blood. Someone was dragging her across the ground. It was Triss. She recognized her by the scent of her perfume. Not far from them, iron-shod hooves rang on the cobbles and yelling resounded. Yennefer saw a rider in full armor, in a white surcoat with a red chevron, pummeling the crowd with a bullwhip from a high lancer's saddle. The stones being hurled by the mob bounced harmlessly off his armor and visor. The horse neighed, thrashed around and kicked. Yennefer felt she had a great potato instead of her upper lip. At least one front tooth had been broken or knocked out and was cutting her tongue painfully. "Triss," she gibbered. teleport us out of here. No, Yennefer.
Triss's voice was very calm and very cold.
They'll kill us. No, Yennefer. I shan't run away. I shan't hide behind the lodger's skirts. And don't worry. I shan't faint from fear like I did at Sodden. I shall vanquish it inside me. I've already vanquished it.
A great pile of compost, dung and waste, in a recess of moss-covered walls, rose up near the exit of the narrow street. It was a magnificent pile. A hill, one could say. The crowd had finally succeeded in seizing and immobilizing the knight and his horse. He was knocked to the ground with a terrible thud, and the mob crawled over him like lice, covering him in a moving layer. After hauling Yennefer up, Triss stood on the top of the pile of garbage and raised her arms in the air. She screamed out a spell, screamed it out with true fury, so piercingly that the crowd fell silent for a split second.
"They'll kill us," Yennefer spat blood, "as sure as anything. Help me."
Triss interrupted the incantation for a moment.
"Help me, Yennefer. We'll cast Altsor's thunder at them." "And we'll kill about 5 of them," thought Yennefer. "Then the rest will tear us to pieces. But very well, Triss, as you wish. If you don't run away, he won't see me running away."
She joined in the incantation. The two of them screamed. The crowd stared at them for a second, but quickly came to their senses. Stones whistled around the sorceresses again. A javelin flew just beside Triss's temple. Triss didn't even flinch.
"It isn't working at all," thought Yennefer. "Our spell isn't working at all. We don't have a chance of casting anything as complicated as Altsor's thunder. Altsor, it is claimed, had a voice like a bell and the diction of an orator. And we're squeaking and mumbling, mixing up the words and the intonation pattern."
She was ready to interrupt the chant and concentrate the rest of her strength on some other spell, capable either of teleporting them both away or treating the charging rabble, for a split second at least, to something unpleasant. But it turned out there was no need. The sky suddenly darkened and clouds teemed above the town. It became devilishly somber, and there was a cold wind.
"Oh my," Yennefer groaned. "I think we've stirred something up."
"Marigold's destructive hailstorm," repeated Nemu. "Actually, that name is used illegally. The spell was never registered because no one ever managed to repeat it after Triss Marigold, for mundane reasons. Triss's mouth was cut and she was speaking indistinctly. Malicious people claim, furthermore, that her tongue was faltering from fear."
"It's hard to believe that."
Condwirrimuir's pouted her lips. "There's no shortage of examples of the venerable Triss's valour and courage. Some chronicles even call her the Fearless.
But I want to ask about something else. One of the legend's versions says that Triss wasn't alone on the Rivian Hill, that Yennefer was there with her."
Nemu looked at the watercolour, portraying the steep black razor-sharp hill against a background of deep blue clouds lit from below. The slender figure of a woman with arms outstretched and hair streaming around was visible on the hill's summit. The rhythmic rattle of the Fisher King's oars reached them from the fog covering the surface of the water.
"If anyone was there with Triss, they didn't endure in the artist's vision," said the Lady of the Lake. "Oh, what a mess," Yennefer repeated. "Look out, Triss."
In a moment, hailstones, angular balls of ice the size of hen's eggs, plummeted onto the town from the black cloud billowing above Rivia. They fell so heavily that the entire square was immediately covered in a thick layer. There was a sudden surge in the throng. People fell, covering their heads. They crawled one under the other, ran away, falling over, crowding into doorways and under arcades, and cowering by walls. Not all of them were successful. Some remained, lying like fish on the ice, which was copiously stained with blood. The hailstones pelted down so hard that the magical shield Yennefer had managed to conjure up over their heads almost at the last moment trembled and threatened to break. She didn't even try any other spells. She knew that what they had triggered could not be halted, that they had unleashed by accident an element that had to run riot, that they had freed a force that had to reach a climax, and would soon reach that climax. At least so she hoped. Lightning flashed. There was a sudden peal of thunder which rumbled on and then gave a crack, making the ground tremble. The hail lashed the roofs and cobblestones. Fragments of shattering hailstones flew all around. The sky brightened up a little. The sun shone. A ray breaking through the clouds lashed the town like a horsewhip. Something escaped Triss's lips, neither a groan nor a sob. The hail was still falling, hammering down, covering the square in a thick layer of icy balls gleaming like diamonds. But now the hail was lighter and more patchy. Yennefer could tell from the change in the thudding on the magical shield, and then it stopped, all at once, all of a sudden. Armed men rushed into the square. Iron shod hooves crunched on the ice. The mob roared and fled, whipped by knouts, struck by spear shafts and the flats of swords.
"Bravo, Triss," Yennefer croaked. "I don't know what that was, but you did a nice job." "There was something worth defending," croaked Triss Merigold, the heroine of the hill. "There always is. Let's run, Triss, because it probably isn't over yet."
It was over. The hail that the sorceresses had unleashed on the town cooled down hot heads, enough for the army to dare to strike and bring order. The soldiers had been afraid before. They knew what they were risking with an attack on the enraged mob, on a rabble drunk on blood and killing, that feared nothing and would retreat before nothing. But the explosion of the elements had brought the cruel, many-headed beast under control, and a charge by the army accomplished the rest. The hailstones had caused awful havoc in the town, and a man who a moment earlier had beaten a dwarf woman to death with a swingle tree and shattered her child's head against a wall was now sobbing, was now weeping, was now swallowing back tears and snot, looking at what was left of the roof of his house. Peace reigned in Rivia. Were it not for the almost 200 mutilated corpses and a dozen burned-down homesteads, one might think nothing had happened. In the district of Elm, on Loch Escalot, over which the gorgeous arc of a rainbow was shining, weeping willows were reflected beautifully in the smooth, mirror-like water. Birds had resumed their singing, and it smelt of wet foliage. Everything looked pastoral. Even the Witcher, lying in a pool of blood, with Ciri kneeling over him. Geralt was unconscious, and as white as a sheet. He lay motionless, but when they stood over him, he began to cough, wheeze, and spit blood. He began to shake and tremble so hard, Ciri couldn't stop him. Yennefer kneeled down beside her. Triss saw that her hands were shaking. She herself suddenly felt as weak as a kitten, and everything went black. Someone held her up, stopped her from falling. She recognized Dandelion.
"It's not working at all,"
she heard Ciri's voice emanating despair.
"Your magic isn't healing him at all, Yennefer."
"We arrived."
Yennefer had difficulty moving her lips.
"We arrived too late."
"Your magic's not working,"
Ciri repeated, as though she hadn't heard her.
"What's it worth then, your confounded magic?"
"You're right, Ciri,"
thought Triss, feeling a lump in her throat.
"We know how to cause a hailstorm, but we can't drive death away, although the latter would seem to be easier."
"We've sent for a physician,"
said the dwarf, standing beside Dandelion hoarsely.
"But he's taken his time."
"It's too late for a physician,"
said Triss, surprising herself by the calm in her voice.
"He's dying."
Geralt trembled once more, coughed up blood, tensed, and went still. Dandelion, supporting Triss, sighed in despair, and the dwarf swore. Yennefer groaned. Her face suddenly changed, contorted and grew ugly.
"There's nothing more pathetic," Ciri said sharply, "than a weeping sorceress. You taught me that yourself. But now you're pathetic. Really pathetic, Yennefer. You and your magic, which isn't fit for anything."
Yennefer didn't respond. She was holding Geralt's limp, paralyzed head in both hands and repeating spells, her voice quavering. Pale blue sparks and crackling glimmers danced over her hands and the witch's cheeks and forehead. Triss knew how much energy spells like that used up. She also knew the spells wouldn't help in any way. She was more than certain that